Today is Monday, December 12th. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residence of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening, it is 5:07 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national and international news.
And now for our local headlines.
BC's Ministry of Education announced changes to the province's funding towards school districts on Friday. Following a review this August where government heard recommendations from districts and education groups, George Abbott, the Minister of Education, announced an overall increase in the education budget. Some of the areas in the educational sector that will see this surplus of funding is the Community Link Program, which provides grants for schools with an increase in vulnerable students and supports school lunch programs, child youth workers, community schools, and literacy and healthy school initiatives. Inner-city schools, particularly those in Vancouver, have been speaking out this fall over lack of sustainable funding for programs such as these, which will see a $5 million increase in funding this year. Schools that are seeing a decline in their population, which is the majority of schools in this province, are guaranteed to get 98.5% of the funding they got last fall. Now, through a press conference, George Abbott said that these changes are a product of collaboration between education partners from all over BC, working together in the shared interest of crafting a more equitable, stable, and sustainable education funding model. But the BC Teachers Federation, although pleased with the extra Community Link funding, is concerned that this new funding formula will force schools in poorer regions to fight with richer schools for funding. The BCTF is also concerned that the overall increase in funding totals only $3 million, an increase of only 0.06% at a time when inflation is running at nearly 3%.
A few dozen protesters set up brief blockades today at entrances to Vancouver's port in a show of solidarity with protesters along the U.S. West Coast. U.S. protesters have launched a movement called Wall Street on the Waterfront, and Vancouver protesters plan to block our local port in solidarity with fellow protesters in San Diego, LA, Oakland, Portland, Tacoma, and Seattle. The original plan was for Vancouver protesters to set up a blockade at the port terminal for 12 hours. But this morning's disruption lasted only 1 hour before the protests moved to a second gate in the port, which was blocked for less than 30 minutes. A spokesperson for the group said that they are not affiliated with the Occupy Vancouver movement. Meanwhile, the vice president of planning and operations at the Port of Vancouver said that plans are in place to deal with more disruptions, although he would not elaborate. Quote, "We certainly support the right to safe and peaceful protest," he said, "but our job is to make sure the port continues to operate, and so far today that has happened, end quote. In local news from the City Hall, City Hall announced today that former BC MLA Olga Illich will be the co-chair of Mayor Gregor Robertson's new Housing Affordability Task Force. Olga Illich was elected to the legislature in 2005, representing the Richmond Centre riding, and served as Labour Minister in 2006 after being the Tourism Minister. Having been in the housing business for 30 years, Illich also served as Executive Vice President of Progressive Construction Limited and President of the Urban Development Institute. Illich said she is looking forward to working with people in the areas of finance, architecture, academia, and real estate to generate new ideas and proposals and address the challenges of unaffordable housing in Vancouver. Mayor Robertson announced last week in his inaugural address that he would be creating a task force that would examine the causes of unaffordable housing in Vancouver, review city land assets for more affordable housing options, and study financial models in other cities to promote it. His motion to create the task force comes before council this Tuesday.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Computers, computers, computers.
Computers from the UBC bookstore are cheaper thanks to their student pricing.
This is the innovative solution to your computation necessities,
including Apple products.
Imagine the savings.
Get yours before you graduate from UBC.
When you graduate, you will no longer be able to take advantage of student pricing.
Visit them today at the corner of East Mall and University Boulevard on UBC campus.
Spend the money you save on yourself. You deserve it.
Go online and search UBC Bookstore on Facebook and Twitter.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from UBC. And thank you very much for being with us. It's now time to take a look at the national news. Canada has officially and formally withdrawn from the Kyoto Accord. Environment Minister Peter Kent said that the decision will save the government about $14 billion in penalties, a wise financial move in these tense economic times. Kent went on to blame what he calls an incompetent Liberal government who signed the accord, then did little to make sure we met our legally binding emissions targets. The Kyoto Protocol expires next year and was committed to reducing annual CO2 emissions in major industrial countries to below 1990 levels, while also providing financial support to developing countries to encourage a worldwide emissions cut. Canada ratified the account in 1997, but we were not on track to meet our obligations to Kyoto. The Conservatives went on to say that they are committed to cutting 17% of our 2005 emission levels by 2020, which is a far, far lower threshold than is expected with Kyoto.
Premier Alison Redford of Alberta plays host to her counterparts from Saskatchewan and BC on Tuesday to discuss the direction of the New West Partnership. The partnership, established in April 2010, created Canada's largest interprovincial barrier-free trade and investment market with a population of 9 million and an economy worth an estimated $550 billion. Alison Redford, Premier Brad Wall of Saskatchewan, and BC Premier Christy Clark are expected to discuss immigration and labour needs, infrastructure work, and the Canadian energy strategy. In May 2010, former Alberta Premier Ed Stelmach, former BC Premier Gordon Campbell, and Wall traveled to China and Japan on a joint mission to encourage trade. The trip marked the opening of the Western Canada Trade and Investment Office in Shanghai. The purpose of the office is to promote Western Canada's natural resources, agriculture, and green technology.
John Duncan, our Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, said over the weekend that Attawapiskat Chief Teresa Spence had agreed to accept an independent third-party manager. Since then, Spence has strongly maintained that she has agreed to nothing, and today went so far as to threaten legal action against the federal government to resist the imposition of a third-party manager, who would effectively take over the tribe's finances. Spence says that she has invited the Aboriginal Affairs Minister and his team to come to the troubled community themselves to look at the books, which apparently has not yet happened. According to Duncan's parliamentary secretary, Greg Rickford, third-party management was put in place about 2 weeks ago. Duncan himself praised Jacques Marion, who is a third-party manager. He praised his work. The manager is already getting results for the community. He's purchased 22 modular homes using federal funds. He's ensuring that services and social services are being delivered. But this claim has come up against a cement wall of opposition. NDP MP Charlie Angus said Marion was not at all involved in an agreement between the community and the department to acquire the homes. John Saunders, the Ontario Director of Disaster Management for the Canadian Red Cross, said that he's never even spoken to the third-party manager. Funds donated to the Red Cross have so far amounted to $300,000 and have gone towards providing space heaters, sleeping bags, winter clothing, fire extinguishers, and first aid kits. Saunders and the Red Cross are now trying to find out what it will take to make Attawapiskat habitable as soon as possible. And to conclude our little stay in national affairs, the NDP had a convention this weekend in Vancouver at the Convention Center celebrating the 50th anniversary of the New Democratic Party in British Columbia. And here are my thoughts on that. The New Democratic Party of British Columbia convened within the walls of the Vancouver Convention Center to celebrate the party's 50th year in existence. The purposes of the weekend's extravaganza were many and varied: a sort of orientation to new delegates, a plethora of addresses from leaders within the party, your usual array of painstaking democratic reports and resolutions, and a town hall debate among the NDP's federal leadership hopefuls. This last point was what initially drew me to the convention. On March 24th of next year, members of the NDP will elect a new leader to fill Jack Layton's shoes and become leader of the opposition. In fact, there is an almost naive devotion to what many members see as an unavoidable fact that the person elected in 3 months' time will no doubt become our next prime minister. You don't hear too much about this young leadership campaign, and I wanted to see what we had to choose from. I would just like to make perfectly clear that I am by no means a New Democrat. I'll admit there were times during the weekend when I found it very difficult to justify to myself why I wouldn't pay a nominal fee and become a full-out member of the NDP. There's no doubting the fact that there is a serious disillusionment among our country's youth regarding politics. And of the three major political parties, the NDP seem to be the only ones making any productive strides towards involving that embittered group of our population. In fact, I found myself agreeing with nearly everything that was said over the course of the weekend. But still, I had serious doubts. When was the last time a federal or even provincial politician came out and said, "I am for social and financial inequality. Let the weak die and the strong thrive"? Never. Which is why it's difficult to take political speeches seriously. How do you gauge the honesty and genuine conviction of a public figure? I'm hoping you can help me out with that. The New Democratic Party of British Columbia convened within the walls of the Vancouver Convention Center to celebrate the party's 50th year in existence. The purposes of the weekend's extravaganza were many and varied: a sort of orientation to new delegates, a plethora of addresses from leaders within the party, your usual array of painstaking democratic reports and resolutions, and a town hall debate among the NDP's federal leadership hopefuls. This last point was what initially drew me to the convention. On March 24th of next year, members of the NDP will elect a new leader to fill Jack Layton's shoes and become leader of the opposition. In fact, there is an almost naive devotion to what many members see as an unavoidable fact that the person elected in 3 months' time will no doubt become our next prime minister. You don't hear too much about this young leadership campaign, and I wanted to see what we had to choose from. I would just like to make perfectly clear that I am by no means a New Democrat. I'll admit there were times during the weekend when I found it very difficult to justify to myself why I wouldn't pay a nominal fee and become a full-out member of the NDP. There's no doubting the fact that there is a serious disillusionment among our country's youth regarding politics. And of the three major political parties, the NDP seem to be the only ones making any productive strides towards involving that embittered group of our population. In fact, I found myself agreeing with nearly everything that was said over the course of the weekend. But still, I had serious doubts. When was the last time a federal or even provincial politician came out and said, "I am for social and financial inequality. Let the weak die and the strong thrive"? Never. Which is why it's difficult to take political speeches seriously. How do you gauge the honesty and genuine conviction of a public figure? I'm hoping you can help me out with that. Saturday was the big one, no doubt about that. Both Friday nights and Sunday morning were more akin to opening and closing ceremonies than anything else. I managed to stagger into the joint at around 10 a.m. The proceedings were already underway, but it didn't look as though I'd missed much. The convention floor was a fairly massive room with comparable proportions to that of a large high school gymnasium. Long rows of neatly lined tables ate up the bulk of the floor space. Seated at these tables were the BCNDP's caucus members and delegates, or in other words, members of the party. When I walked in, the delegates were having a reports and resolutions session. This is undoubtedly one of the dullest forms of democracy you are likely to be subjected to. I didn't have any of the reports with me, so I had no way of knowing just what in Christ's hell these people were voting on. To their credit, the voting was swift, conducted by a show of hands, or more precisely, a show of laminated blue cards that read, "Leadership you can count on." The subject of these votes were mundane and sometimes excruciatingly precise changes and amendments to some party publication that I have not yet had the misfortune to read. Luckily, these proceedings did not last very long after my arrival. At about 10:15, Adrian Dix was scheduled to speak to the assembly. And he marched on stage wearing his token uniform, dark blue blazer and trousers, a baby blue silken shirt, and an orange tie. He began with a 45-minute history lesson on the BCNDP, dropping names like jelly beans and occasionally twitching his facial muscles in his awkward ferret-like way. When the history portion of the speech had concluded, and the time had come to get down to issues of policy and change, a noticeable change came over Adrian's overall demeanor. He sprang up, squared off to the crowd, feet shoulder-width apart, looking very much like General Patton addressing his troops. Dix went on to outline a sort of tentative platform for the provincial election in 2 years. "The economy will be the primary concern of the next general election," Dix said, linking the financial inequality to a recent downfall in BC's public education system and a lack of skilled laborers.
"I don't think what parents and teachers, what students are asking for is much. But they want us to respect our obligations with respect to class size and composition. And they want us not to judge a public school on one test in grade 4. They want us to assess the value of our public education."
Dix whipped the crowd of 700 or so into an absolute screeching frenzy, saying, "We need a government that is working with public school teachers, not fighting with public school teachers." The last part of the sentence was completely stifled by thunderous applause. He also touched on the possibilities in BC for growth in our resources, citing New Zealand's policy as one we can look up to.
"And we have in our people an enormous possibility to reach out to the world. Other jurisdictions like New Zealand, 4 million people just like British Columbia, have planned job plans. It's not just about sending politicians around the world, they actually have a strategy. The focus on industries and the advantages their country has. And they have offices around the world, and they meet targets every year, and they have more success in trading than just about any country in the world, isolated New Zealand. We can do better than that."
And in keeping with the fashions of the day, Dix just couldn't resist blasting Stephen Harper and his government's recently passed crime bill, the Safe Streets and Communities Act.
"We saw an increase this year, believe it or not, of 80% per month of stays of proceedings in adult criminal cases. That means that people get let off because we don't get them to trial on time. And what Mr. Harper is promoting, and what Ms. Clark is saying, and there are some things in the bill we're supporting, but what they're saying fundamentally is that we've got to increase and add mandatory minimums for things like relatively small amounts of marijuana. And the consequences of that in our system are this. The consequences is that nobody will plead guilty, that criminals who commit violent crimes are more likely to go free."
After 90 minutes, Dix concluded his speech and managed to reiterate the NDP's so-called core values in terms that are sure to become his campaign platform in 2013. He finished his speech by introducing every single NDP caucus member, as well as the party's newest hopefuls, with special emphasis on Joe Trasolini, the NDP's newest superstar in the Port Moody electorate, all to the fading tune of the Black Eyed Peas' "Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night." April may be silly, but tomorrow's hangover might prove unbearable. And that is part one of two of CITR's adventure at the NDP convention. We will have two later on, but right now it's time for the weekday weather forecast.
Yes, thank you, Martin. Well, folks, this looks like a grim week, so get your hot chocolate and your umbrellas ready, because it's just going to be rain the entire time. Tonight, we see a few clouds, increasing cloudiness near midnight, so stay indoors. You see a low of -2. On Tuesday, it's cloudy, a high of +4. On Wednesday, it's cloudy with 60% chance of flurries or rain showers, with a high of +3. Thursday is also cloudy, a low of +2 and a high of +5. Friday is cloudy with 60% chance of snow or rain, so get your snow boots ready and stay indoors as much as possible. That would be a low of +1 and a high of +5. Saturday is rain, a low of +2 and a high of +6. Sunday, of course, again cloudy with a 60% chance of showers, low of +2 and a high of 6. That was your weekday weather forecast brought to you by CJ on behalf of the Storm Club.
Yeah, that was like the weekly bummer right there.
That's pretty grim.
Yeah.
Hopefully the sun will come out as it always does in Vancouver and you're really surprised and things will be good.
That was your weekday weather forecast, and before that, we had your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up after the break, we're going to delve into some international news.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. Thanks for being with us. It's now time for international news. We're going to pass things over to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Neil Abram with FSRN Headlines. Syria held local elections today as fierce fighting erupted on at least three fronts between opposition members and Syrian troops. Jackson Allers reports from Beirut.
Businesses were closed and children kept home from school in cities across Syria today in protest of the Syrian regime's pushing ahead with municipal elections. Anti-regime protesters view the vote as a meaningless reform concession by President Bashar al-Assad, and voter turnout is said to be very low. Fighting erupted in the south and spread to new regions throughout the day, continuing for a second day in Dara, where the government crackdown began in March. In the hotbed of armed resistance, Homs, opposition fighters have been ordered to put down their weapons and surrender by Monday night, or face an all-out assault by government forces on Tuesday. The nationwide strike today is also aimed at adding economic pressure on Assad to adhere to an Arab League proposal that seeks to end the government crackdown that the UN says has killed at least 4,000 opposition protesters. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut, Lebanon.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review another hot-button political case. This spring, the court will review Arizona's SB 1070, the controversial anti-immigrant bill that the Obama administration says oversteps federal law. A decision is due in the summer. At about the same time, the court will consider health care reform in a claim that the government overstepped federal authority. And last Friday, the high court blocked gerrymandered voting districts in Texas. The justices will hear arguments in that case in early January. Low-wage workers in San Francisco will be the first in the U.S. to earn a minimum wage above $10 an hour. Under local law, minimum wage in the city increases yearly. The bump is determined by the inflation rate and local cost of living. Fair wage advocates say it's still not enough. Despite the new minimum wage of $10.24 an hour, a living wage for a single adult without kids is $15 an hour. Lowe's Big Box Hardware Stores released a statement on its Facebook page today, admitting that they canceled advertising during the broadcast of a reality show called All American Muslim. The program follows the everyday lives of five Muslim families in Dearborn, Michigan. Lowe's decision to cancel its ads came after the company was targeted by the Florida Family Association. The group claims that the program, broadcast on the Learning Channel, is an attempt to, quote, manipulate Americans into ignoring the threat of jihad. Despite broad public protest over the weekend, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has rejected demands to hold a new parliamentary election. The Prime Minister's office said today that the amount of potentially falsified ballots accounts for only about 0.5% of total votes. Ekaterina Danilova reports that protesters are vowing to continue.
In addition to calling for a new election, protest organizers have issued a list of demands. They want the government to release opposition leaders who are sitting in prison, and they want all opposition parties officially registered. Protesters are hoping to keep building the pressure on the government following hugely successful protests this weekend. Up to 200,000 people across the country came out in opposition to the current regime in the largest protest for the past 20 years. In St. Petersburg, an estimated 10,000 people attended the protest. One opposition party leader was among many speakers who called for people to continue their actions.
We have only one path to demand from the government honest elections, free elections, and we must succeed. One more time, Russia will be free.
If demands are not met, more protests are scheduled for December 24th. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
The political crisis in South Ossetia settled this weekend. President Eduard Kokoity resigned after the nation's Supreme Court annulled the November 27th poll, in which a woman won over the Kremlin-backed candidate. But MJ Raquelme explains, not everyone is happy with the deal.
After a fortnight of protests, things in Skhinvali seem to be back to normal. A deal between President Kokoity and election winner Ala Gioeva was reached over the weekend. Under the agreement, current Prime Minister Vadim Brodsiev will be the Republic's interim leader until new elections are held in March. For balance, an opposition representative will be appointed as Deputy Prime Minister and Gioeva will be allowed to present her candidacy in the next election. The deal is signed, but Gioeva does not seem convinced, saying that Kokoity has neglected some points of the agreement and that if they are not implemented, she has the right to annul her signature. MJ Riquelme, FSRN, Tbilisi.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, incumbent President Joseph Kabila admitted mistakes today after a widely criticized vote which declared him the winner last week. But he defended the election, which has been marked by thousands of lost votes and irregularities. The Carter Center, which observed the voting, said the election, quote, lacked credibility, and leading opposition candidate Etienne Tshisekedi disputed the outcome and declared himself president. The confusion has led to violence, with residents in some Kinshasa neighborhoods reporting armed police raiding homes and arresting people suspected of opposing Kabila. Opposition members are calling for a revote and say more protests are planned this week. For more, we're joined by George Zongola, professor of African studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of The Congo, From Leopold to Kabila, A People's History. Welcome to FSRN.
My pleasure.
Today, the Roman Catholic Church, which sent out some 30,000 election monitors, called into question the election results, saying that the results do not conform to truth nor justice. This comes on top of the Carter Center criticism of the election. Talk about the voting process itself and the results.
The voting process was marred by a lot of irregularities. Many voters could not find their names on the electoral rolls at the polling stations they were supposed to vote at. Many voting stations did not have the ballots for president, only had ballots for members of the National Assembly. Some polling stations were fictitious, did not exist. Many ballots were found already marked in favor of Kabila. So there were a lot of irregularities. But there's no doubt that the votes who did happen to vote, they voted their conscience. And most of the voters, as far as we can tell, voted for Mr. Tshisekedi.
So Mr. Tshisekedi, he's also declared himself winner. He's Mr. Kabila's primary opponent. What is his background and what is he offering voters?
Mr. Tshisekedi is the historical leader of the democracy movement in the Congo. He has been fighting for democracy since 1980. And this is since December 1980. He went through a lot of torture in Mobutu's cells and remote detention camps around the country, and persisted, created his party, the UDPS, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, in 1982, in a country where one party was a rule and opposition parties were illegal. In 1992, he was elected prime minister by the Sovereign National Conference, a constitutional and political reform convention consisting of 2,842 Congolese, and I was privileged to be a participant in that great assembly held by the Congolese people.
Now, a discussion of politics in the DRC needs to also include discussion about foreign influence and regional influence as well. You have pointed out that even in the city of Kinshasa, which is not far from the Inga Dam, one of the largest hydroelectric projects in the world, people go days without electricity and sometimes even shortages of water. The DRC is also a region rich in mineral resources. Talk about the influence of foreign companies and governments such as the U.S. and how mineral wealth influences politics in the area.
Very much so. The Congo is a victim of its wealth. Neighboring countries such as Angola, Rwanda, and Uganda have continued to plunder the Congo of its resources. And these also happen to be countries that are close allies of the United States. And this is why we don't understand the hypocrisy of the United States. Why Mrs. Clinton, the Secretary of State, should make a statement condemning elections in Russia as fraudulent. And so far, she has not made any statement condemning the election in the Congo as fraudulent. The fraud in the Congo was much more blatant and at much higher scale than in Russia. So the question is, are black people not entitled to the same respect for their views and their rights as white people around the world? This is some of the questions I want to know.
And opposition leaders and those critical of the election outcome have pledged more protests in the coming week. George Zongola is professor of African studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the author of The Congo, From Leopold to Kabila, A People's History. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
As communities continue to develop strategies to respond to the effects of climate change, a new report from the UN Environment Program finds that women are especially vulnerable. UN Radio's Jerry Adams asked UNEP spokesperson Jim Sniffen why women are disproportionately affected.
All vulnerable segments of society, including women and children, are disproportionately affected by climate change because they lack, in many cases, options to adapt to it, to react to it, to its impacts. They're in many ways locked into the physical setting where the impacts are occurring, or they don't have the financial or the social wherewithal to adapt and move on to other options, both physically and economically.
The report also says that women, particularly in mountain regions in developing countries, face higher risks to their livelihoods and health from climate change. Why mountain regions?
Well, the report uses case studies, particularly from the Himalayas, because one of the collaborating centers that we work with is based in Nepal, and they've been doing a lot of work on climate change in the region. But this report focuses on the gender aspects of impact and hopefully the responses to it. But women, particularly those working in agriculture, are disproportionately affected in that particular region or mountains in general, because there are a high percentage of subsistence farmers are handled by women to meet day-to-day needs. It's also because the women are the energy providers by wood gathering, not just adult women, but younger women, girls. They tend to be much more involved in that economic sector where, again, they don't have much room for maneuver if they are impacted by heavy rains, drought, the extremes of water management, both too much and too little.
It also mentioned Nepal in terms of trafficking in women and that it increases with climate disaster.
One of the organizations that contributed to this report was Interpol. And what they have found in general with regard to social disruption, disasters of any kind, is that there is a spike in the numbers and percentage of trafficking cases. And they are using anecdotal information so far to surmise that natural disaster disruptions that may be caused by changes in climate and rainfall patterns, floods and so forth, have contributed to a spike in that region in trafficking, not just of women, but trafficking in general, children as well.
That was UN Environment Program spokesperson Jim Sniffen.
Well, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to three women this year: the Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Lema Bawi, a social worker and peace campaigner from the same country in Liberia. And they shared the prize with Tawakkul Karman, an activist and journalist who played a key opposition role in Yemen. The three were chosen for their nonviolent struggle against injustice, sexual violence, and repression. And these Nobel Peace Prize laureates were interviewed by CNN's Jonathan Mann in an hour-long special interview in Oslo. And News 101 would like to play a clip from that interview where these women discuss the importance of women's rights in today's
Beyond
world.
Beyond fighting for our individual countries, we are fighting for the emancipation of women and girls. If you look back at the two continents that I represented, you see a lot of young women who have lost hope, and they're like grouping in the dark, looking for mentors to really bring them to that place. So that is the war front that we find ourselves on.
Is there any sense that you're all here because of, your tokenism, sexism, that you're all just lumped together
Jonathan,
because you're women?
I won't even allow you to end. We work very hard for this. We work very, very hard. It's been a long time coming.
We deserve it.
Gender may have had a small dimension to play in the results of the struggle, but I also think it's respect for courage. And those who were face down at a time that people were threatened, anyone who stood up with the courage to confront them, with the courage to be able to fight them, I think gained a lot of respect and a lot of admiration, and that had some part to play in it.
You have two options. One, take a gun, especially in a conflict situation. The second one is to do something different from what the others have been doing. And I was thinking, I'm already dead. So why not just die in the process of leaving a legacy? Fortunately for me, there were some women who were thinking the same way, and we stepped out. We had to change the destiny of Liberia to give our children the future that they deserved.
Even if there isn't drinking water or jobs or healthcare, if there's at least peace still 6 years from now, will that be enough for you to have been a success?
Oh, definitely. I'm already a success. And in the next 6 years, I'm quite sure there will be peace, there will be water, there will be lights, there will be good roads, there will be schools, there will be clinics. We are going to make Liberia a post-conflict success story. We're well on the way, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Ali Saleh will not implement anything. He just wants to enter Yemen to the civil war.
So what's going to happen to you? Because you said just a moment ago, you're going to run for president. The election, I think, is February 21st. If Saleh is still there, if the transition is an illusion, is it safe for you to return to run for president? And are you really going to do it? Are you serious?
Yes, I am serious. I said, if I will candidate, I will win.
Well, if you're a candidate, are you
yes.
a candidate? You're announcing today?
But,
are you declaring your candidacy now?
But I will tell you something. How can I say it? Will they allow me to candidate? We have more than 28,000 people injured and killed in the street for their dignity, for democracy, for freedom, for human rights, for anti-corruption, for good governance. I candidate myself.
What are you going to do with the money? Tawakkol Karman, have you given it any thought?
Taking them back to Yemeni people. It's Yemeni people money.
We said it from the day we won the prize. The money is for the women of Liberia. They worked for it. They earned it. We're taking it back. And I ask them to continue what they know to do best.
That was Liberian... that was actually CNN's Jonathan Mann interviewing Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Lema Bawi, and Tawakkol Karman. The three women won the Nobel Peace Prize this year.
And before that, we had the international headlines and a couple stories by Free Speech Radio News. You can catch their headlines and full newscast at fsrn.org. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And it's now time for the second of two installments at CITR's Adventure in the NDP Convention this weekend. The convention eventually crawled its way into the afternoon, where a special guest speaker was scheduled to address the assembly. I'd never heard of Van Jones before Saturday, and I'm told he's an American environmental advocate, civil rights activist, as well as an attorney. He was briefly appointed by U.S. President Barack Obama to the position of Special Advisor for Green Jobs, Enterprise and Innovation at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. But he had to resign after only 6 months when he was embroiled in controversy over his past political affiliations. Now I was sitting idly, trying my best to wait patiently while proceedings got underway. We were running late, and it seemed like we might be in jeopardy of falling seriously behind schedule. But suddenly, a rather large man with a graying beard and glasses trudged his way to the microphone. He looked very much like a union goon. Now, I must admit that my instincts are sometimes so finely honed that it borders on prophecy. And I was thinking just that when the faceless voice controlling the PA system introduced this man as Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers Union. I was skeptical that Gerard would lay any wisdom on this crowd. His union speak was an instant turnoff for me. Never should the current leader of the BCNDP be called Brother Dix, I felt. But all the same, there it was. So I settled in for what I imagined would be an excruciating 2 hours of vague party platitudes. But Leo Gerard almost instantly put me on my toes, showing unwavering sympathy towards those involved in the recent Occupy movement.
We had young people that were at a young workers' conference, and they probably saw the same thing I saw that night on television. They were interviewing a young person, and they said, "Why are you here?" And that young man was probably about 26, 27 years old. He said, "I'm here because I did what I was told I should do. I went to school and I got 2 master's degrees. I've got student loans that I can't afford to pay the interest on, and I can't find a job. And they caused it. That's why I'm here. And we should never forget that."
By the time he started blasting the government over inconsistencies in their public health care policies, Leo Gerard had total command of the room's attention.
Almost $20,000 per year for family coverage.
If you figure that out from collective bargaining point of view, that's $10 an hour. In British Columbia or Ontario or anywhere else in Canada, I would be shocked if it was costing us more than $6,000 a year per family. So when you get a government, provincial or federal, telling you that you can't afford the healthcare system, Adrian had it right this morning. It's not that we can't afford to have it, it's that we can't afford not to have it, and we ought to tell them to stick it in the sun.
Although Girard's address was brief, it set the tone for Van Jones, upping the emotional intensity of the crowd to a feverish pitch. Van Jones sauntered on stage, tall, bald, and fit-looking. He managed to convey the sense of imminent threat that consumes young minds today. Jones managed to sprinkle his message with bouts of court jester-like comedic behavior. At times, he reminded me of a parody on Martin Lawrence. All the same, his statement cut so deep, you couldn't ignore their urgency.
A whole generation. Every spring, they graduate off a cliff into the worst economy since the Great Depression. Not just here, all around the world. We're going to have, somebody said, maybe a billion jobs short. We're going to be a billion jobs short on this planet. Think about that. What does it mean to be 18, 19, 20 years old? To look around and see all this work that needs to be done. To see the roads and the bridges that need to be fixed. To see the young people who need to be educated. To see the old people who need to be taken care of and respected in their old years. To see all the new technologies that need to be invented and deployed and maintained. To see a civilization that needs to be repowered. And not to be able to even get an unpaid internship to start on the road and making your contribution.
As an environmental activist and author of The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems, all were anticipating his wisdom on the lack of investment in renewable energy going on in the world today. And he managed to convey a sense of dread and flat-out rage in no less poetic terms.
They want us to drill holes and pull the coal out of the ground. They want us to drill holes and pull the oil out of the ground. They want us to drill holes and knock down landscapes and drag up tar sands. Why are they digging all these holes? What do they bring up when they dig those holes? They're bringing up death. Coal is something that's been dead for 300 million years. They're bringing up death. Oil has been dead for 60 million years. They bring up death. That's their great answer. Power human civilization for 7 billion people with death. And then they're shocked when, based on their strategy, we get death in the lungs of our children with asthma. We get death on the oceans with oil spills. We get death in the skies with climate change. But no one should be shocked, because their whole strategy is to power our civilization with death.
Jones ended on an optimistic note for our province, both congratulating us on our good fortune and also heeding a strong warning of things to come.
Renewable energy in a way that powers your growth here and that powers your society here. It doesn't just power the profit of some foreign corporation. You should be proud of yourself. You should be proud of yourself. Again, these people who have no record of increasing jobs for anybody, these big polluters, come to you and put their finger in your face and tell you you have no track record on jobs and they're the only ones. What are they talking about? In this province alone, $15 billion with a B, $15 billion was generated last year alone in the green sector. That's 10%. 10% is the green sector right now, and that's with no leadership from the government. Imagine what that could be if you had some leadership.
When Van Jones left the stage, I was beginning to get a pretty clear picture of what the NDP stood for. They're a party that has had to struggle to be taken seriously on a federal as well as a provincial levels. They might be disenfranchised at the way things are going in this country today, but they hold hope in the population of this country to turn things around the next chance they get. There's been a lot of talk within the walls of the NDP convention. The overall message seems to be quite optimistic, almost to the point of outright delusion. There seems to be no doubt in the minds of the NDP party members that they will win the next provincial election, and that whoever is elected leader of the NDP on March 24th will be sitting in the captain's chair in Ottawa. They are laying the groundwork for provincial and federal campaigns, the results of which will have a serious impact on the future involvement in the NDP. Their priorities and overall message are pretty clear. Economic inequality must be addressed at all levels of government. They see solutions to the growing gap among the rich and poor in reinvigorating public educational institutions and teaching our society that we need to produce more skilled workers if we ever want to catch up to the wealthy, who are speeding away with this country's money like rabid animals down the Autobahn. The NDP want to invest in renewable energy, not to axe job in traditional sectors, but to create what is being dubbed green jobs, creating new and innovative employment. They also plan on investing heavily in alternative energy sources, incorporating hydro, wind turbines, and solar panels into our infrastructure. Nobody who is even vaguely intelligent in this 21st century could possibly argue with these values. But then again, this is politics, a game where it's excruciatingly difficult to tell who you can and can't trust. Which begs the question, do the NDP really mean it? Is Brother Dix leading the NDP with the spirit of a genuine cavalier for fundamental change? Or is he simply riding the party's values like a limo to the premiership? There is, however unfortunate, only one way to find out. And that was CITR's adventure at the NDP convention over the weekend. I apologize we never got to the leadership debate, but we have 3 months to hash that out, and I'm sure we'll get around to it. You're listening to News 101. We'll be back in just a second.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Where else can you see Hollywood blockbusters, midnight cult classics, indie films, live music, burlesque, stand-up comedy, poetry slams, and live sporting events all at your local theater? Your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
This December at the Rio, you won't want to miss the Western Wilderness Committee presenting Naomi Klein live on Thursday, December 1st, saying no to pipelines and no to the tar sands, with Naomi Klein speaking live about the people-powered movement to stop tankers and pipelines right here in Vancouver. For some late-night fun, check out A Very Harold and Kumar Christmas in 3D. This special 3D offering will play for one night only, Thursday, December 1st. Running daily from the 1st until the 8th, catch Surviving Progress. Inspired by the bestseller, A Short History of Progress, Surviving Progress chronicles how past civilizations were destroyed by progress traps. Midnight movies at the Rio go down every Friday night, and features this month include Die Hard, Home Alone, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and Goodfellas. For more information on everything happening at the Rio Theater, check out their schedule at riotheater.ca/schedule.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan.
We're broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and I think... Is there anything on your mind, CJ?
Well, I'd just like to know, you were at the NDP conference. What did they have to say about the Keystone Pipeline, or even the Kitimat project? Kitimat?
One of the candidates, Peggy Nash, I think she was the only one who addressed it over the weekend, directly anyways. And she said she voiced regret. She thought we should get rid of it. She said, all the NDP candidates seem to be pretty eco... sympathetic, I guess you could say that.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. They didn't say. I mean, they were all pretty much alike in one way or the other. It was weird because they were all saying really good things and they were being polite, even though they're all nine of them scrambling to get into the same chair.
Did any of them mention why it's so hard to engage with the Harper government on this issue? Like, do.
Not directly.
But why do you think they find it so hard to convince Harper that this might be a mistake?
Well, probably, because I would imagine Harper's been in power for, what, about 8 years now? Six, seven?
Something like
he's
that.
He's been waiting for a majority government, which he's just now has for about 6 months, which kind of gives him carte blanche to do everything that he's wanted to do for the past 6 years. If I had to guess, like, yeah, I've never met the guy, but I'd imagine he's not listening to anybody right now. He's doing what he wants to do and what he thinks is right, and if the opposition thinks otherwise, tough to tooties.
That's true. And what about issues regarding First Nations rights and things of that nature?
The Attawapiskat thing was pretty front and center, and it's pretty deplorable. I think it's become obvious the way this was handled. At first, it seemed like the federal government were giving the money that the funds were being mishandled. But I don't think that may have been irresponsible on the federal government's behalf to blame the people who are living in these horrible conditions for not spending their funds properly. And that's an overall thing, especially for the NDP and especially for the BC NDP, that you need to start, after how many hundreds of years, to start treating Aboriginal people with, at the very least, a little bit of respect so that you can start engaging them face-to-face on a respectful level rather than bringing in a third-party candidate, because apparently communications have broken down to such an extent that chiefs and the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs can't even sit down and speak to one another side by side. They need a liaison, an interpreter. It's kind of shameful.
Well.
And we had a caller, but they're gone now.
Anyway, that's our program December 12th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. Today's show was produced entirely by volunteer efforts, those of Marty and CJ to be specific. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.